Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to speak this morning, if you give me a little more volume, I'd like to speak this morning on the subject of deep sustainability. An ecotheist or ecotheistic view of big history. And as with all good sermons, I got 3 points. The bad news, or the great reckoning, the big picture, like how did we get in this mess, and then the good news, what do we do? And I need to warn you, the good news is still very, very sobering. So, to speak about the bad news, to speak about the challenges of our time, not just politically and economically, but also climate-wise, and I could go through overpopulation, species extinction, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, social inequality. There are so many things I could focus on that all of us know and have experienced, and members of our family have experienced, are bad news, challenging times. So I'd like to speak about 2 things that are not problems that can be solved. They are now predicaments that need to be adapted to, lived with, evolved with. See, there's a fundamental difference. In fact, my mentor, William Catton, made this distinction between problems and predicaments. We're so used to thinking of things as problems that can be solved if we just throw enough energy and human ingenuity at something, we think we can solve the problem. And that's been our experience for much of the 20th century and some of the 19th century. The problem is that some of these problems actually metastasize and become predicaments. Predicaments can't be solved. Predicaments, like death, is a predicament. We have to live with it and ultimately die with it. We have to adapt to it. It's a reality. It's not a problem that can be solved, no matter how much some techno-optimist would like to believe that we're going to conquer death. This is a delusion. So I'd like to speak about 2 predicaments. One is that we have inherited not just centuries, but millennia of anti-future thinking, anti-nature thinking, ultimately self-destructive thinking. For example, we've inherited, and I'm talking even to the atheists and humanists and free thinkers, we've inherited in terms of our culture has inherited a human-centered understanding of God, a human-centered understanding of religion, a human-centered understanding of progress. And ultimately that's suicidal. See, I want to draw attention to an analogy. We've been thinking for about 500 years, but it actually goes back, this human-centeredness, this anthropocentrism, goes back actually several thousand years. But we've been thinking in terms of human-centeredness in an extreme way for the last 500 years because we started inventing technologies like the pendulum clock. And once we invented the clock, the clock became the primary analogy for primary reality. So we imagine God as a clockmaker outside a clockwork universe in the same way that I as a man am outside of this pulpit. Let's just say I made this. And so the pulpit is separate from me, outside of me. So God begins to be imagined in completely trivial, impotent, inconsequential ways, ultimately suicidal ways, as a being outside the universe that if you believe in this external being, this otherworldly entity, then you're a theist. And if you disbelieve in this otherworldly entity, you're an atheist. And both sides treat the living, pulsing presence of the biosphere as an it that we think we can exploit, rather than a thou to be honored and respected. So this clockwork mechanistic universe has completely given us a suicidal understanding of God, a totally human-centered, otherworldly, transcendent-only understanding. And what we know scientifically is that every sustainable culture, for the first 97% or 98% of human history, we lived more or less in a mutually enhancing relationship with primary reality. In other words, we related to primary reality as primary. The soil, the forest, the life upon which we depend is primary. It's our literal creator, sustainer, and end. It is that one reality in which we live and move and have our being. And yet that reality began to be personified and mythologized in a variety of ways, increasingly otherworldly once we had the mechanistic universe. So one of the things that we are inheritors of, we didn't choose this, we were born into this. For hundreds, indeed thousands of years, is this human-centered understanding of religion, God, the environment. Right, think about it, the environment. The environment is not our surroundings, it's our source, sustenance, and end. And yet by calling primary reality, that is the living biosphere, the environment, we think that we can do what we want with it because our true home is somewhere else when we die. For conservative religious people, at least, that's their belief. And so one of the predicaments we live in is that we are inheritors of an anti-future way of thinking that has been embodied in most of our institutions. I'll say a whole lot more about this at 6 o'clock tonight. The other predicament that we are now needing to deal with is the fundamental dimension of reality is ecological reality. Ultimately, the laws of ecology and physics trump the laws of economy, economics, and can be neither bribed nor bought. And so one of the laws of ecology is that there is a limit, sacred limit, to how much the biosphere can provide and how much waste it can absorb before systems start breaking down. That's really the essence of sustainability. Sustainability is living in a way that you could live for tens of thousands of years without diminishing or destroying your primary base. The soil, the forest, the life upon which we depend. Living unsustainably is living in a way and having numbers that you take more than the system can provide and you exude more waste than the system can absorb, so the systems start breaking down. And we are living in a profoundly unsustainable way. Not because we're bad, rotten, evil, crummy, sinful people, but we've inherited a worldview and an understanding of religion that doesn't do what religion has got to do and has always done for the first 97% of human history, which is it's the role of religion. It wasn't even called religion, it was life ways. But it was the role of the meaning-making, symbolic community, ritualizing community, to ensure that the future was never compromised by the present. If we allow the future to be compromised by the present, you can be sure that religion is asleep at the wheel. Actually, that's not even strong enough. Half of religion, most of the liberals, are gagged and tied in the trunk. The other half of religion, most of the conservatives, are in the back seat cheering on the psychopathic politicians that are driving us over the cliff. Religion is not playing the essential role of ensuring that the future is not compromised by the present. So that's why we need the greening of religion. That's one of the reasons why I wear this green clergy shirt, this Celtic green clergy shirt, is because the Celtics integrated earth-honoring wisdom and the traditional religion. So the predicament that we're in is that Europe had achieved saturation. Europe was actually in overshoot. They were living in a way that the soil was being depleted, the forests were being wiped out, and there was so much population pressure that there was all kinds of conflict in Europe. And then, from the European perspective, an entire new hemisphere was discovered. Now, of course, it was fully inhabited by indigenous Americans, but because our germs went ahead of most of us and wiped out 90% of the indigenous Americans, from the European perspective, it occurred to be an uninhabited continent, full of resources of every kind. In fact, limitlessness was the belief of the day. There was limitless timber, limitless fish, limitless animals of all kinds. And then when we discovered coal, oil, natural gas, limitless energy, or so we thought. Limitless everything, or so we thought. And so the institutions and the mindset, the expectations of North Americans especially, reflected this sense of limitless possibilities, limitless opportunities, and limitless ability to exploit the living world for human benefit, or so we thought. And then we shipped that mindset and shipped those institutions and those expectations all around the world. So the people in India and China and Bangladesh and Brazil and the European Union expect, and this is what they're being sold in terms of our media and corporate propaganda, they expect to be able to live like the people in this room. middle-class Americans. And yet we would need seven or more planets of resources to provide that much resources and to absorb that much waste. It's not possible. So the fundamental predicament of humanity is two things. One, we've inherited anti-future ways of thinking about almost everything. And we are living in a post-age of exuberance world, but we have an age of exuberance mindset. See, exuberance is actually an ecological term. Any species that comes into a habitat that it didn't have access to before that's conducive for its thrival, population goes skyrocketing. And when you measure the hormones, basically they think life is good. And it is. It is. Until they have overshot their energy base. You could call it peak trees for most of human history. Or peak oil, or peak whatever, whatever the energy source is. And then on the downside of the bell curve, things shift. Because what's possible in expanding economies and expanding civilizations is not the same thing that's possible in contracting economies, contracting civilizations. So this is the fundamental predicament of humanity. We have inherited anti-future, ultimately suicidal ways of thinking, especially about religion. And we're living in a world of carrying capacity. That's what it's called ecologically, carrying capacity. We are living in a carrying capacity deficit world, yet we have carrying capacity surplus mindset and institutions. And that's the fundamental predicament. So, that's the bad news. What's the big picture that can help us understand this? Well, if you compress big history, or the history of everyone and everything, into 100 years, just so that we can get our heads and hearts around a 100-year timeline, at that time scale, at day 2, all the hydrogen formed, at age 67, our solar system formed. At 69, Earth cools below the boiling point of water, and it rains for eons, and the oceans formed. All there's been is some icy comets that have added to it, but that's basically how the oceans were formed. The dinosaurs life, Earth comes alive in 70, and at 71, some of these bacteria start harnessing the photons of the sun. We call that photosynthesis. And then you got the whole complexification of life from May of 98 until July or August of 99. On a 100-year time scale, the dinosaurs are here. They die out in August of 99. Do you know when human beings show up on this time scale? To use mythic or religious language, when the goddess or when God created us was on the last week of a 100-year process. On roughly December 25th of the 99th year is when we emerge out of the body of life. On December 29th, we domesticated fire, and we've been speaking in words, symbolic language, where words point to that which they can never capture fully. On the last day, December 31st of the 99th year, you've got 99 years, 364 days, the last day of a 100-year process is when we emerge out of the body of life, or to speak mythically, when God or the goddess created us. Now, I don't know about you, but if we show up on the last day of a 100-year process, clearly the whole thing wasn't meant for us. In other words, big history, to use mythic language, and I always use the word God and reality interchangeably. Reality is God's secular name, or God is a mythic personification of reality. And reality is telling us some really, really important things about what we need to do to live in right relationship to reality so that we can stop destroying the future and we can co-create a just, healthy, and sustainably life-giving future. That's not going to happen, however, before we hit the cliff, before we hit the wall. There are certain things that are now inevitable. And one of them is the decline of the American empire. Empires don't last forever. They typically last about 250 years. And our decline is right on schedule. The Rust Belt is a decline of industrial civilization. We are seeing the decline. See, we talk about the collapse of the Roman Empire. It wasn't like this. It took 320 years for Rome to collapse. It was a stair step with partial recoveries. That's the way civilizations contract. So on this last day on a 100-year process. We lived more or less sustainably from midnight of December 31st. I mean December 30th. Midnight of December 30th until about 11:20 p.m. on December 31st. So like 96, 97% of the day, we lived as hunter-gatherers in a mutually enhancing relationship. Then we started basically mining metals and creating weapons, and then there was this arms race, and it became totalitarian agriculture. It was all about humans. We were going to basically, it's all about us. And that human-centeredness caused us to basically rape the natural world for our benefit. So the living world kept getting worse and worse, yet human beings seemed to get better and healthier, wealthier, why, you know, all this kind of stuff and all the knowledge. The problem is that's not sustainable. And so when you look at this time scale, one of the things we know is that we have 32 examples, at least 32 examples of civilizations that became great, and then their own greatness becomes their own undoing, and they collapse, and then there's a dark age. And another civilization becomes great, and it typically takes somewhere between 1 and 4 or 5 centuries to become great, and 1 or 2 centuries to collapse. We usually collapse about twice as fast. And we see this over and over again. And if you set these civilizations side by side and look at the common patterns, you realize that we become great in many different ways, but we almost all collapse the same. There's a certain insanity to the process and a certain regularity to the process, in the same way that we're all different and yet we all die in a pretty limited number of ways. We all grow old and die in very similar ways. So do cultures that are not living sustainably. That is, that are not living in a, what I would call, when I speak in religious settings, a God-honoring way. Not God as an otherworldly entity, but God as a sacred proper name for the living, pulsing presence of the biosphere. I spell God, G-O-D-D-E, now often. It's the way the Old English, it's the way the word was spelled in Old English, but many feminists and pagans and Catholic nuns are spelling it that way, because both, it's Old English, but it also, it's not, because it sounds the same, God, but it looks different, it forces people out of the idea that what we're talking about is an otherworldly entity. We're talking about the universe personified, reality personified, time personified. The past is telling us some really important things that we will never, ever hear if we're caught in what I call the triple idolatries. Idolatry of the written word, idolatry of the otherworldly, and idolatry of beliefs. Most religious people, certainly on the conservative end, are caught in one of these idolatries. Idolatry of the written word is where we think our best map of reality is frozen in time in some ancient text. Idolatry of the otherworldly is where we think ultimate reality resides is only outside time and nature. And idolatry of beliefs is when we privilege beliefs over knowledge. See, reality has been revealing things for hundreds of years through science, through evidence. Yet if religious people value old men and old books over evidence, we're in serious trouble. Because then we're going to be blind and deaf to what God, reality, is revealing through evidence about what we need to do to come back home to right relationship to reality. So that's what we get from this epic of evolution, this big history. And this evening at 6 o'clock, I've got about 20 slides that just show the details of this, and it's so inspiring, even though it's like, oh my God, why doesn't everybody learn this stuff? So then finally, and again, I know I'm just touching on this stuff right now, the bad news, the big picture. What's the good news? Well, I call the good news the great homecoming. Yes, we are in the early stages of the great reckoning. We've been living out of right relationship to reality, whether you use secular or religious names for reality, it doesn't matter. We've been living out of right relationship to reality, and we're now about to experience consequences of biblical proportion. Okay, most of that is unavoidable. But we still have the choice. What we do in the next decade could make the difference between, to use religious metaphors, hell and purgatory. We can't avoid purgatory. There's going to be serious challenges in the coming centuries, the coming decades. But it doesn't have to be hell. And so it really matters what we do over the course of the next decade and longer. And it turns out that religion has a vital role. So one of the things, and I'll conclude with this, is that one of the things we learn that's deeply inspiring is that religion can be born again. Religion can be saved, hopefully in time, to spare our species from creating truly hell and from engendering the condemnation of our great-grandchildren. Because make no mistake, there will be a judgment day. It's just not otherworldly. Our great-grandchildren will judge us. You bet. It's just not otherworldly. And so one of the things we learn is that religion plays the essential role of ensuring that the past is never, I mean, the future is never compromised by the present. And it does it through four mechanisms or four ways. One is to basically insist that primary reality is honored as primary. To use religious language, God first, but not God as an otherworldly entity, the biosphere first. In other words, it's measuring success in life-centered terms. How well is the soil doing decade by decade? How well are the forests doing decade by decade? What's the carbon in the atmosphere decade by decade? How are other species doing decade by decade? That is life-centered measures of progress. And that is essential for sustainability. Every sustainable culture for which we have evidence measured success not in human-centered terms like gross domestic product or gross national product, but in life-centered terms. It's one of the essential, one of the four essential things. The second is, it's summed up in the Iroquois notion of the seventh generation. That is the recognition that the future needs to judge our decisions in the present because our decisions in the present will impact them, whether we're aware of it or not. So that idea of not doing anything in the present that would be harmful to the next seven generations is a sacred principle, and religion is the only institution that can further that. It's standing for the future. So, God first, or primary reality as primary, future, seventh generation, the future judges, the present. The third is this idea of sacred limits. There is a limit to how much we can take. I call it the sacred principle of enoughness. The sacred principle of enoughness. It's basically saying, it's kind of going through life with the attitude, thank you, but I've had enough. It's being with what's so, and not always craving more because the advertising industry is trying to do that. You know, we're going through a major national crisis. Go shopping! This is collective insanity. And yet that's the kind of economic system we live in. We live in an economic system, to use mythic language, that's demonic. And I know Unitarians don't use that kind of language, but what I mean is this. If good and evil have always been defined by how we impact the larger community and how that ripples out to the future, like, you know, if I do something good and kind and generous, I've done a good thing. If I do something that's harmful to others or harmful to the future, I've done a bad thing. If I sacrifice to be a blessing to others or the future, I've done a heroic thing or a great thing. But if I self-centeredly serve my own needs, to hell with others. Who cares about the future? Then I've done an evil thing. So in that sense, demonic is any system, an economic or political system that makes it easier or inevitable for billions of us to harm the future just by pursuing the good life. So we've got this kind of system because we've had a way of thinking about religion that hasn't honored primary reality's primary. It's not honored the future first and let the future judge our decisions. And it hasn't honored sacred limits, grace limits. There's a limit to what we can do before the grace of that relationship is diminished. Think about it in terms of marriages. There's a limit to what that marriage can sustain before the grace of that marriage goes away. In every relationship, there are grace limits. So, primary reality is primary, or God first, G-O-D-D-E, the biosphere first. Future judges, seventh generation, sacred limits, and then finally consequence capture. We can no longer allow individuals and corporations to get wealthy in ways that harm the larger body of life or in ways that destroy the future. This is, whether you call it insane, crazy, or evil, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have a future. So we need to make sure that individuals, corporations, and nations that do good to the larger common good benefit. And the more they good they do, the more they benefit. So they're incentivized to do as much good as possible. And individuals, corporations, and nations that have a harmful effect on the larger body of life or the future should be taxed or penalized, or there's moral strictures so that it's in their self-interest to do the right, just, ecological thing, and it's also in their self-interest to not do the unjust, unecological thing. What can we do? Well, I'll get into that a lot more at 6 o'clock. But one of the things we can do is recognize that standing for the future may be our most important sacred responsibility as religious people. And being a voice for that, there's nothing more important than downshifting our lifestyles and collectively building deeper, closer relationships, because we are going to have hard times. We are living in a declining world, not an expanding world, in every possible sense. And that can be a great blessing. I mean, think about it from the perspective of young men. There are tens of millions of young men in the United States, Canada, Europe, China, India, all over the world that are profoundly addicted to internet gaming, internet porn, or both. That won't be the case when their communities need them. And that's going to be really soon. It's going to be a salvation of an entire generation of young men. Their communities will need them again. So we can filter for the upside of down. That is, we're going through contraction, but there can be tremendous blessings. Because haven't you talked to people that went through the depression, and yet they said this is some of the most meaningful times in their life? Because we find joy and meaning when we can be a blessing to others, when we can support others and receive support. It's when true community matters. When churches are no longer places people come on Sundays, but we're involved in each other's lives in deep and meaningful ways. And we Unitarians can lead the way because we're not tied to idolatry of the written word, idolatry of the otherworldly, and idolatry of beliefs. We have moved beyond, for most of us, we've already begun to move beyond human-centeredness or anthropocentrism. We already value primary reality. And so it's furthering that, but stepping up the prophetic rhetoric and stepping up our own downshifting. As one of our friends and mentors, John Michael Greers, calls it, he says, collapse now and avoid the rush. And we all get to do that. And we get to do it in a way that stirs our souls and nourishes our souls, and in a way that future generations will be proud of us for. And I can't think of a better calling.